You know, that was of course excluded because it was before the government. And how could a man be educated by Jean-Jacques ever dream of becoming the subject of a death?
Well, let's take something more realistic.
And the question would only be Switzerland and, well, perhaps France after all.
Venice, England?
France? Yeah, England, you're quite right. But of course, we discussed entirely the question of what the other end would do in such a case. Whether they would accept the message of it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
I see I'm getting myself into trouble already on what I said, but the point is, how do you reconcile the statement of the Supreme Choice, which I interpret as a kind of a possibility, but still the duty to love your countrymen who protected you during your childhood?
Yeah, that is not so simple. According to Rousseau's official teaching in the social contract, if you have fulfilled your military duty, paid your taxes or the equivalent of that, then you may, in a legally arranged manner, cease to be a citizen of that country and become, and leave it and become a citizen. That is not, well, after all, I mean, if he refers you explicitly to the social contract in the Emir, it is the safe assumption that for a full understanding of the Emir, one should also read the social contract. Yeah, I mean, that is not a far-fetched demand. That if you want to understand the immediate social contract and vice versa. Now let us come then to the travel section, in which there are a number of remarks. Let us turn to page 415, in the fourth paragraph.
But is it necessary to travel the whole globe to study mankind? Need we go to Japan to study Europeans? Need we know every individual before we know the species? No. There are men so much alike that it is not worthwhile to study them individually. When you have seen a dozen Frenchmen, you have seen them all. Though one cannot say as much of English as other nations, it is, however, certain that every nation has its own specific character, which is derived by induction for the study, not of one, but of many of its members.
Yes, this year has even this meaning in French. Some, yeah. Yes.
He who has compared a dozen nations knows men, just as he who has compared a dozen Frenchmen knows the French.
Yeah. The point is that, I mean, that is crucial for the whole argument of Rousseau. Everywhere there are national characters. And the basis is simply, he has lived in a number of countries, in Switzerland, France, England, and then he has seen that they are, a Frenchman differs from an Englishman, in spite of all complexity. The basis is induction, and induction has to be the old Aristotelian sense, not the sense of present-day social science. You have seen it in a number of cases, uncontested experience. You know nothing to the contrary, so you can leave it at that. This is the first general statement. Now, let us read at the bottom of this page.
There are Frenchmen in every corner of the globe. In no country in the world do you find more people who have traveled than in France. And yet of all the nations of Europe, that which is seen most knows least. The English are also travelers, but they travel in another fashion. These two nations must always be at opposite extremes. The English nobility travels, the French stays at home. The French people travel, the English stays at home. This difference does credit, I think, to the English. The French almost always travel to their own end. The English do not seek their fortune in other lands, unless in the way of commerce and with their hands full. When they travel, it is to spend their money, not to live by their wits. They are too proud to fringe before strangers. This is why they learn more abroad than the French, who have other fish to fry. Yet the English have their national prejudices. But these prejudices are not so much the result of ignorance as of feeling. The Englishman's prejudices are the result of pride, the Frenchman's are due to vanity.
Yeah, the great compliment to the English. So this was, of course, the greatest subject in a way of comparison of nations in the 18th century, the French and the English. And almost in every continental novel there occurs a milor, as the French say, and who exhibits this strange quality of being subject of a, well, somehow who can elect his government. You know, it's so different from the mere subjects of French. And also has this thing which is called the spleen. I mean, a peculiar whimsicalness which the continentals didn't find. Anyway, I thought this is quite amusing. But later on page 416 and the fourth paragraph, now that is, it's perhaps too long to read. Now let us read this paragraph beginning a bit later. On page 16, paragraph 4, yeah. One must also
be admitted that the original characteristics of different nations are changing day by day.
Yeah, and so by day it's more than changing. Erasing things, I think. There is a more simple English word which does not occur to me.
Day by day, and are therefore more difficult to grasp. As races blend and nations intermingle, those national differences which formerly struck the observer at first sight gradually disappear. Before our time, every nation remained more or less cut off from the rest. The means of communication were fewer, there was less traveling, less of mutual or conflicting interests, less political and civil intercourse between nation and nation, whose intricate schemes of royal business called diplomacy were less frequent. There were no permanent ambassadors resident at foreign courts, long voyages were rare, there was little foreign trade, and what little there was either the work of princes who employed foreigners, or of people of no account who had no influence with others and did nothing to bring the nations together. The relations between Europe and Asia in the present century are a hundredfold more numerous than those between Gaul and Spain in the past. Europe alone was less accessible than the whole world is now.
Less populated. Less populated the whole service now. Now, so in other words, national characters are about to disappear, at least in Europe. Now, how does Rousseau think of that? Let us skip the next paragraph and then go on.
This is why the ancient distinctions of race, the effects of soil and climate, made a greater difference between nation and nation in respect of temperament, looks, manners, and character than can be distinguished in our own time, when the fickleness of Europe leaves no time for natural causes to work, when the forests are cut down and the marshes drained, when the earth is more generally, though less thoroughly, tilled, so that the same differences between country and country can no longer be detected, even in purely physical features.
So in other words, the natural causes, so that is the point which Rousseau has in mind. The fundamental reason why there are national differences are national differences are natural causes, climate and other things, as he says here, the biographically omitted. But Rousseau doesn't speak here, why this is that this is an undesirable development, that he emphasizes elsewhere. And this is, of course, the theoretical basis for nationalism later on in the 19th century, but on the basis of Rousseau. This natural difference is that it's good that the human race is divided into a variety of people, naturally divided, and that has something to do with the goodness of nature. This is not done by men, from their nature. There is only one step from here to the natural boundary, it's a good boundary. Yeah. You know, yeah, sure. The rivers and high mountains or whatever natural boundaries may be. At the end of the paragraph after this, the second paragraph, he says, the commerce and art which mingle and confound the people.
At the same time, prevent them from studying each other.
Yeah. Now, and we have seen how Rousseau thought about commerce and art already in the first discourse. This modern development, which now has, of course, become worldwide, no longer limited to Europe, this leveling development is not to Rousseau's taste, as we know. Now, the purpose here, however, is not to speak about the desirability or undesirability of the development, but what it means to the study of foreign nations. The study of foreign nations becomes the more difficult, the more they become similar. I mean, at the time when it was possible to recognize a people from its food, its drink, and the way in which they sleep, and of course also the higher things, seasons, the more you get everywhere to say food and drink and so on, and that is of course spreading very rapidly in our age. You mean, what are these differences?
Well,
one is struck by them and it is hard to nail them down.
As an American, being in a European country, almost always, you encounter the question, well, is religion here to know?
Mm-hmm. I see.
What do you people eat when you tell us about your breakfast and things like that?
Mm-hmm. I see.
What are these?
Yeah, yeah.
It's just to show that somehow opinions
are deep. Well, I think the English are still most easily recognizable by their eating habits. I mean, in British breakfast and British high tea are unexchangeable with anything else. But I believe that when one looks for an ethnic character, one will be deceived. If one does not look for them, and just occasionally something comes to your attention, and you think of it for the first time, then one can be reasonably sure that one has reached on safe ground. And then I believe languages vary with one, and I do not mean what linguists do, you know, the grammatical and syntactic question, but for which things there are words in a given language and no words in another language that I always found, I mean, ordinary things that I found. For example, that the German word gemütlich is untranslatable into English, and the English word generosity is untranslatable in German. But I found all this very helpful from my own teaching. And also,
Yeah.
But that's in German, Spain.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It's a solid point up to show a direction in saying that you find more of these differences outside of the
state. Yeah, sure. Yeah. No, but what was a very tiny beginning around 1762 has now become a terrific stream, and you know we didn't do the river. That's clear. But the fact still remains, it is only more difficult. It becomes more technical, as it were, to speak about it. Also, the rapid changes within nations. Of course, if someone would say there are invariable national characters, then it would be hard put to prove that. But, when you read descriptions of the various nations in the 16th century, and compared, that film has that list, I remember now. I forgot about the French, the Germans, the English and the Spaniards, And the English are there described as devils, because they were so disobedient to their king. Yeah? And in other words, rebellious nation. No one, I believe, would say that the English in a later age. So these things do change. Yes.
Very important for Nietzsche, the coming together of strong Cartesian
characteristics
and
boundaries
in Europe. And I never quite sure whether Nietzsche agrees with Weber or opposes it. And he seems to oppose the heading, the heading.
Yeah.
And to look forward to the new man, the European.
Yes, yes.
And yet, somehow, he's really. And
yeah, but on the other hand, but it's hard to say whether Nietzsche looked at it only, accepted it only grudgingly. That is hard to say, because after all, from one point of view, he welcomes his development to some higher human possibility, as he thought, you know, than any previous. You have kept beyond the Nietzsche, but he thinks a development of man is now possible, surpassing all earlier developments. Now this new development is bound up, politically speaking, with the unity of Europe, and to that extent surely welcomed it. I mean, he would not have welcomed a union on the lowest common basis, on the basis of merely utilitarian basis. This is, I think, a defensive position. I mean, after all, if men would agree only on a live and let live on the lowest basis, that wouldn't be good. I mean, in other words, if each would forget its best heritage for the sake of a common denominator of all on the lowest level, I believe you would not think that this is good for you. And this, of course, today also true in the whole question of East and West.
Yeah.
I mean, India and China, I mean non-red China, and the rest, whether this should take place on the level of the lowest logical positivism and its concomitant. As you know, that this can be learned by anyone, anywhere, within a short time, and an agreement for it, or in consideration of the deepest thoughts of both sides and the end of an understanding of the two sides, of mutualizing of both sides at their highest. That would obviously be very different. The latter we can have very easily every day, as a form, I mean. You know? Yeah. As every social science convention shows, as all of you have attended that convention, I did not, surely you know better than I did. Now, he also continues the issue of traveling in the sequel, page 418. He describes the philosopher's way of traveling, and speaking here of the example of Plato and Thales, Plato and Pythagoras. Perhaps he reads this paragraph 4 on page 118.
To travel to see foreign lands or to see foreign nations are two very different things. The former is the usual aim of the tourist, the latter is merely subordinate to it. If you wish to travel as a philosopher, you should reverse this order. The child observes things till he is old enough to study men. Men should begin by studying his fellow. It is therefore illogical to conclude that travel is useless because we travel ill. But granting the usefulness of travel, does it follow that it is good for all of us? Far from it. There are very few people who are really fit to travel. It is only good for those who are strong enough in themselves to listen to the voice of error without being deceived, strong enough to see the example of vice without being led away by it,
Now let us go on. But he describes it, something he's worth reading by all means. What the conditions for fruitful traveling are. I do not know whether in these organizations now responsible for traveling, especially of social scientists, these things are considered. It might be a good idea if the Rockefeller Foundation would bring out this booklet and condensing the most solid things here, or from other writers, and I don't know, so might not be there. Now, here there is an exhortation on page 419 in the third paragraph to the political subject.
No.
And the parallel with marriage, does this seem to be quite clear? I have here a note that there is a parallel with marriage in both cases, the contract of marriage, the social contract, and therefore fits well together. Now let us now turn to the political discussion proper, which begins on page 421 in the fourth paragraph.
The science of politics is, and probably always will be, unknown.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
Grotius, our leader in this branch of learning, is only a child.
Oh, excuse me, what was the first word of the political right, yeah? It's a correct impression.
Oh.
What does he say? What did you think?
She says the science of politics.
No, he doesn't speak of this. Political right. Yeah, political right. You can say public law.
Is, and probably always will be unknown. Grotius, our leader in this branch of learning, is only a child, and what is worse, an untruthful child. When I hear Grotius praise
of bad faith, he even says.
When I hear Grotius praise to the sky, and aunt overwhelmed with abuse, I perceive how little sensible men have read or understood these authors. As a matter of fact, their principles are exactly alike. They only differ in their mode of expression. Their methods are also different. Hobbes relies on sophism. Grotius relies on the poet. They are agreed in everything else.
Yeah, that's a typical third circle. Now, what do we make of that? We have seen something about Rousseau's relation to Hobbes at the beginning of the second discourse. Here he speaks only of what separates him from Hobbes, and there is a negative. But still, Hobbes is getting relatively good press. He is not worse than Grotius. Now, Grotius, of course, was a star in heaven. And Rousseau paid a great compliment to Hobbes to say that Grotius is a bit better than this execrated Hobbes. Yeah. Good. Now, let us continue. So this is a beginning. Both are, well, what he means, of course, is that Grotius quotes poets all the time to show that a certain view of life was well known throughout the times. And Hobbes, of course, does not quote poets. He has only syllogisms. But Hobbes says these syllogisms are sophisms, meaning, what does he mean precisely? Not that the premises are wrong, but I suppose that Hobbes argues badly. And it will, in a way, it will be made clear to people. Now go on. The next. He begins surely like a reformer of a science. Yeah? The science does not exist. That's as Hobbes says that. Hobbes gets it back now. Hobbes hasn't changed the situation a bit. Now?
In modern times, the only man who could have created this vast and useless science was the illustrious Montesquieu. But he was not concerned with the principles of political law. He was content to deal with the positive laws of settled government. And nothing could be more different than these two branches of study.
What do you say to this? I mean, is this a good judgment among the two?
This is very, very empirical, because it's certainly, if you're approaching Montesquieu, but there's one one adjective that illustrates modifies this time, it's a great and useless time.
But that's useless because of the stupidity of men. Not in other words, de facto useless. De jure, the most useful of all that. That's what he means. No, and I think in a way it's of course correct. Because Montesquieu describes the positive law of practically all nations, sure. But in another sense it's of course not true, because the implication is a public law, which is different. For example, the doctrine of separation of powers is clearly not meant merely as a historical statement about the British or the Roman constitution, but it's meant to be. This is the sound order wherever you can have it. Yeah. But in a crude way, it's of course correct. Now, he makes it a bit clearer in this picture.
Yet he who would judge wisely in matters of actual government is forced to combine the two. He must know what ought to be in order to judge what is. The chief difficulty in the way of throwing light upon this important matter is to induce an individual to discuss and to answer these two questions. How does it concern me, and what can I do? Emile is in a position to answer both.
You know, here Rousseau is obviously correct, isn't it? You cannot judge if you do not know what ought to be. This is, I think, elementary. And therefore, our social science, in its wisdom, denying knowledge of what ought to be, says no value judgments, whatever. Don't judge. That's right. Now the next part.
The next difficulty is due to the prejudices of childhood, the principles in which we were brought up. It is due above all to the partiality of authors who are always talking about truth, though they care very little about it. It is only their own interests that they care for, and of these they say nothing. Now, the nation has not... The people has neither professorship, nor pensions, nor membership in the academy to bestow. How then shall its rights be established by men of that type?
You see, now comes an attack of a much broader character. See, earlier political philosophers, they are not only incompetent, but they are also corrupt, because they are there, whether they admit it or not, or whether they knew it or not, dependent on the powers that be. The first political philosopher, not under in the thrall of the power that be, but speaking for the people who do not give shares in the residence of the Rousseau. But that is before Marx. No, Rousseau was in a way, that is I think quite true, the first, Hobbes wrote, there's no question, I don't want to marry his character, but in his first version he was strictly Dewar, in practical, and then he was strictly Cromwell, and at the end he was strictly Dewar. He was never on the side of the popular party, the Puritan party, was strictly correct. Rousseau speaks as a man of the, I think he's the first philosopher who explicitly speaks as a man of the people. I wouldn't know any earlier. Maybe I forgot someone. I mean, we had there are popular movements using philosophic doctrines, but that's not a matter. But as a philosopher, I think he's the first. He is surely the philosopher of democracy. Contrary to claims of them, there is only one who could be said to have been the first philosopher who was a philosopher of liberal democracy, and that was Spinoza. Now, Spinoza surely was not a man of the people, but he came as close as he could to it. He wrote in his pocketbook, he drew a self-portrait in the costume of Masaniello. Neapolitan revolutionary of the 17th century. this was rather, I mean, that was an approximation to the philosopher revolutionary, but it was strictly imitative art, not Rousseau came much closer to that. That I think is not unimportant for this whole modern development where philosophy, political philosophy gradually became call to action, call to action, ideology, as it is now called.
Do you want to say that?
Yes, the way you tell this out is certainly the important thing that I wondered about was taking the specific sentence which does occur later in the social context, or the people doesn't give professorship attention or academic attention. That would apply perhaps to, most certainly to those people, perhaps to us. But would it be fair to most?
Yeah, but Montesquieu is in a way excluded because he limited himself strictly to positive law. And now, what does he say then about Emile? I have done in such a way that this difficulty would be zero for Emile. Yeah?
He scarcely knows what is meant by nothing. His business is to find the best. He does not want to write books, if ever he
does. Yeah, and so on, that we know. But he barely knows what government is, and the only thing which he ought to know is the best government. This is, of course, an extreme statement. It would seem to imply that you can know what the best government is without knowing what government is. This also can hardly mean, but there is some suggestion of the distinction between your government ought to be and what it is, that the question what ought to be can be answered independently of the question of what is. And I mean, if one is very literal, one can find a confirmation of that in Rousseau's famous remarks, so often quoted against him, écartons les faits. Let's disregard the fact, which has been much more, in the second discourse, which has a much more limited meaning. But surely you cannot find out what the best government is by studying the actual government, because you have already to have a standard for distinguishing among them which are better and worse, because you can't, that you have, that you do not get by merely looking at them. Clear. Now in the next paragraph, well, in the next paragraph he draws the conclusion, great talents are less required for this new science than a sincere love of justice and a genuine respect for the truth, because the temptation is so great that you are bribed by the powers that be. That has ruined more or less all earlier political philosophy, as it seems to say.
There's a reference to Emile too, not talented, but
Yeah, he can, this he can understand, yeah. And this, by the way, would be a point of view for this, for the comparison between the summary of the social contract and the social contract itself, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
This is what Emile can and must learn. If there are other things in it, I mean other important things, not subdivisions, in the social conduct, they are not necessary for Emile. Emile, especially to make the most important case, Emile doesn't have to know anything about the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
Surely, of course.
But there's one thing that troubles me in this paragraph. It seems that the specious difficulty is, can I do this or not? Right? Because there remains a third difficulty, more specious than solid, and that I don't want to resolve nor to propose. But he never says what the difficulty is. Now, just reading the paragraph over, it seems that the question is,
let it read it then, this paragraph. There remains the third difficulty.
There is the third difficulty. More specious than real. A difficulty which I neither desire to solve, nor even to think. Enough that I am not afraid of it. Sure I am that in inquiry to this kind, great talents are less necessary than a genuine love of justice and a sincere reverence for truth. If matters of government can ever be fairly discussed, now or never is our chance.
Yeah, there are two possibilities occurring to me when I have not to reconsider this. The first is, are you, Jean-Jacques, the man who believes to succeed where all these good men have failed? And then there would be an answer. It is not a matter of outstanding genius, but of sincere feeling for the mass of the people. Mm-hmm. Good. That's number one. But there is obviously also something else when he says, here is now or never. Now or never. That must have to do not with Rousseau in particular, but with the time. With the time. This time is the most favorable time to discover the political truth. And this could only mean, in my opinion, that a revolution is coming, and to either to prevent it or to give it a desirable turn.
Yes.
Couldn't it mean this time the
human development?
Uh-huh.
And for justice and reverence to the truth of a purity. There could be, yeah. He's talking about himself.
The translator, mother is one and two.
But the long walk
in the desert. You know, I will not exclude it without further consideration. The reason why I do not believe it, because I would see he would have had no hesitation to stay safe. And he doesn't wish to stay. Yeah.
The thing that this drew in my mind was the chapter that precedes this of the conference doesn't have any title or anything, but after he states the problem, he says, if I were a prince or a legislator, I wouldn't try and do these things. I wouldn't talk about these things. I
would do them. Yeah.
And then he goes on to say how the citizen of a state, a republic, and so forth. That's sort of as he is here, bolstering his own case for being able to treat these men.
Yeah, that could be. There is a passage which I cannot find here. My reference must be wrong. Before observing, how does the next paragraph read?
Okay.
One must make oneself free. Yeah?
Before beginning an observation, we must lay down rules of procedure.
Rules for one's observation. Yeah.
Rules for one's observation. We must find a scale with which to compare our measurements. Our principles of political law are our scale. Our actual measurements are the civil law of each country.
The political law of each country, meaning the positive public law. So in other words, Emil will have the standard for judgment before he goes silent. Yeah? Now this, of course, is that it is not based on the observation of the country, doesn't mean that this is a so-called a priori bias. But it is not. It is based on the nature of things. On the nature of things, or the nature of man, fundamentally. Public law became an a priori science only after Rousseau in Kant. In Rousseau itself, it has still an empirical basis. The empirical basis being self-regulation. The time is advancing in an atrocious manner. We can read only one more point on page 423, the second paragraph. So now, he begins then the argument, yeah? By the way, here is the paragraph which I meant. You know, our elements will be clear, simple, taken directly from the nature of the thing. There will be a question will form itself and so on and so on. And then he begins for instance, quite informally. In other words, it is not a formal enumeration of all the items that they discussed. And actually, this is not, it's not haphazardly made, as a clear point. Now, did you make any observation regarding the first paragraph, Mr. Butterworth?
Yeah, the first thing is that
This somehow embodies the first chapter, book one, chapter two of the social contract, but in a way that isn't stated in the social contract.
Yeah, sure, but I would say that altogether up to the point where it comes to the social contract itself, he simply summarizes the first five or six chapters of the social contract. I didn't find any substantive difference.
But certainly,
the mission which... Yeah, but I think the only...
One omission that I think is important is the fact that he doesn't emphasize the self-preservation,
the
fortune, and the society.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but this one can rightly say he has heard so much about self-preservation in this book that this is not necessary. Yeah.
I thought that it might be that Emil was not that concerned with it.
Because he's also undergone the training of the theatrical.
Especially
that. Now, only one more point and then we must stop. That is page 423, second paragraph, which is very short.
We shall inquire whether man might not say that all sickness comes from God, and that it is therefore a crime to send it to the doctor.
Yeah, this thought is not developed in the first chapter that I haven't looked at it in so long.
This is in the third chapter.
But in that context?
Yes.
Yeah. So now what does he mean by this statement?
This somehow has to do with if God gives us a despotic ruling, which is a
sickness,
can we...
Sure, no, he has a very definite passage of the New Testament in mind. Romans 13:1. That every soul is subject under the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. And he says that is true, but every sickness also is of God, and this is compatible with medicine. And therefore we may do something about the powers powers coming from God. Yes?
And then not the first right go back to the model of the whole book. Nature has given us the remedy to
of the meaning, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Sure, what he has clearly in mind. Yeah. Now let us read one more paragraph. On the same page, paragraph 5.
Suppose we reject this theory that might is right, and admit the right of nature, or the authority of the Father, as the foundation of society. We shall inquire into the extent of this authority. What is its foundation in nature? Has it any other ground but that of its usefulness to the child, its weakness, and the natural love which its father feels towards it? For the child is no longer feeble, when he has grown up in mind as well as in body, does not he become the sole judge of what is necessary for his preservation? Is he not therefore his own master, independent of all men, even of his father himself? For is it not still more certain that the son loves himself than that the father loves the son?
Yeah, this is of course a classic Hobbesian argument, and this is the way in which he disposes of the second reasoning discussed at the beginning of the first is rule derivative from force is impossible. Now, can political rule be derived from paternal power? Second possibility, also rejected. And then the result is rule can only be derived from contract. That's the overall argument. Now, and in this particular passage, I thought it is important because it makes clear that self-preservation is mentioned here, all right. And everyone, of course, if he's no longer a child, the judge. And the reason given, because everyone is nearest to himself. The famous story, the fool is more interested in his self-preservation than the wise man can be in the fool's self-preservation, and therefore the fool is much better off if he is a judge than if he has to go to the wise man to ask him for guidance. This tough pedestrian argument of Hobbes is here in black. Yes.
The thing that I was trying to do is the qualitative difference is something that he goes over so rapidly, whereas in contact it's brought up again and again.
Yeah, no, naturally, but I think that I would say it's perfectly intelligent because he has been fed to this doctrine of self-preservation, amor de soi, so much that if you don't know it by now, you can learn it better. That is, I think, not a difference. I admit and emphasize that it would be highly interesting to make a thorough comparison of these two statements of the soul and see what the differences are. Whether the results would be sufficiently interesting to justify a master thesis, for example, to speak in practical terms, I could not say without having done it. My general impression is that the chief difference is A, the science about the legislator, and B, the elaboration of the argument regarding international law, international relations, yeah, which has no parallel.
The one other thing that I thought was quite important is that Emile is not taught that he can, if he feels himself injured, if he even fellow students tell him that they can call back the government. He's taught exactly the opposite.
You will remind us next time when we come to the question. Only one more point, which we will take up again next time, on page 423, in the second paragraph from the bottom. Passing then to the right of slavery.
Taking next the law of slavery, we shall inquire whether a man can make over to another his right to himself without restriction, without reserve, without any kind of condition. That is to say, can he renounce his person, his life, his reason, his very self? Can
no,
he renounce
his I, his ego?
Okay. Can he renounce all morality in his actions? In a word, can he cease to exist before his death in spite of nature, who places him directly in charge of his own preservation, in spite of reason and conscience, which tell him what to do and what to leave undone?
Yes, that is an extremely interesting passage, again, because it refers back to this. Only now the line is drawn differently. Nature and reason and conscience belong together. Nature, you will see, has only to do with its proper conservation. It is an absolutely foolish act to ever to make a contract of slavery, where you give away all power to preserve yourself and hand it over to your master. Yeah? That is simple and clear. And now the other point, conscience and reason, but the conscience mentioned first here. Conscience and reason, prescribing what he ought to do and from what he ought to abstain. This has to do with his reason. We can say with the dignity of man, let us put it this way. Yeah? Here there is no dignity of man involved. Every beast would do it if it could think. Yeah? I mean, not to get itself addressed, obviously, because it is not conducive to self-preservation if someone else possesses all means of your self-preservation. It's a mad action from the lowest and most solid one of these. Here's the consideration of man's morality, and as we can say, of man's dignity. It is incompatible with man's dignity to be a slave. These are obviously two very different reasons, and yet, thanks to the goodness of nature, both converge. Both are equally incompatible with any right of slavery. So this, I believe, has a general importance. Rousseau makes this distinction as a distinction between nature, which has to do only with self-preservation, and reason on the one hand and conscience on the other. It is not so easy to make, but it is somehow underlying the whole Rousseauan teaching. And yet there is a considerable agreement between in the consequences following from nature and the consequences following from reason and from conscience. And therefore Rousseau is perfectly entitled to blur the difference for most practical. But when it comes to the question of principles, the theoretical understanding, then it becomes very necessary to make the distinction. Is this point clear? I mean, these three items which we have here found again, we have seen before when we discussed it, and this of course requires a very thorough study. And I believe the earlier remark is much clearer because something, it was illustrated to some extent. You know, the not succumbing to temptation was a characteristic example of conscience, whereas reason it tells us that we should not build the impossible. Now, by the way, I forgot to mention that the difference is obvious. If someone succumbs to a temptation, he does not attempt the impossible, because succumbing is obviously impossible. Yes? Otherwise, so the distinction would make sense. In other words, the reason as understood there is indeed not the same as nature, but it is surely not the same as morality proper. This I can confirm. Morality proper and virtue belong much more to conscience than to reason. But, now next we have still a lot to discuss, and while we surely will have the next meeting with Mr. Lane reading the paper, and Mr. Boyne reading the paper, but we will not, I hope we still have some time for a general discussion of the meaning of the whole.
And the combination of comedy and tragedy is only a kind of secondary illustration of that. And the case, and what you said, the philosopher king, of course, but the philosopher must not be only a king, there you can say that he's somewhat fantastic suggestion. The philosopher must also be a rhetorician here. I mean, and must possess the art of speaking, which is not simply identical with philosophy proper, and so on. Now, if we take this seriously for one moment, we would reach this tentative conclusion that, at least in this initial part of the Republic, Plato abstracts from philosophy. I mean, from that art, if we can call it that way, which is surely incompatible with a simple self-sufficiency or every other simple non-connectedness of the many arts. And therefore philosophy, and that is perfectly in order, because that's the politics of it, not philosophy. Philosophy comes into the Republic not on its own feet, if I may say so, but is brought in very indirectly, according to the explicit argument. We have the process finished in Book 5, completed, no objection, all objections have been refuted. And then the question arises, but how can we get it? And only as a means for getting it, not as an ingredient, an essential ingredient of the good city, is philosophy introduced. So this abstraction from philosophy is of the essence of the first half of the world. And that is a kind of shock that this mere means, philosophy, should prove to be the end. And and that has good reasons, because if philosophy as such is the end, the whole political life becomes a problem. The title of the Republic in Greek, Politeia, does not merely mean what a constitution or regime, but it means the political life. The political life. That is the question. And the book starts from the premise that the political life is the highest life, the only is the life truly in accordance with what man is. And this premise, which is never questioned, which always presupposed, is becomes question in from at least Book 6 on. So now I have made a very long speech. And next time we will hear Mr. Serzo on Book 4. Is it correct? Mm-hmm.